What do you believe is the most important thing that you should do before you die? And do you know what the most common beliefs we have are regarding death? These are not topics that we like to talk about all the time. They're not happy topics, but they're important topics. And the more you are prepared, the better off your family and your loved ones will be. Are you ready? This is the Dental Elements Podcast, the podcast that is for everyone in the profession. Join us for a refreshing conversation with innovators, collaborators, and inspirers. Cheers to that. On today's show, my guest is Dr. Kimberly Harms. Dr. Kim has been around the block in life. She has served as a commissioned officer in the United States Public Health Service. She has been a dental school professor, a grief counselor, a death doula, a civil mediator, a clinical dentist, also a school board chair, president of an international women's organization, the first woman president of the Minnesota Dental Association, a national spokesperson for the American Dental Association, an award-winning best-selling author, and international speaker. She has also suffered many personal losses, which we will talk about today. Her most important role is as a mother to her two surviving children and grandmother to six precious grandchildren.
I'm 67 years old. And at that age, I've been through a lot in my life, as many people who get older have a lot going in their lives, a lot of loss. I lost my mother and my son to suicide, and I lost my husband to a broken heart, just I think because of the suicide death of my son. And each of those losses, you lose part of your identity whenever you have a loss. So I lost my identity as a daughter when my mother died, my identity as a mother of a son when my son died, and my identity as a wife when my husband died. So from those experiences, I realized how death has such an impact on the survivors, on all of us. When my husband died, my grandchildren in particular were really affected negatively by his death. They missed their pop-up so much. And I started to think, well, I'm next up to the plate, hopefully. I don't want to lose any more children. So I wanted to be next up to the plate. So I'm next up. What can I do to help my children and my grandchildren survive and thrive without me in their lives? And I started doing some research and I ended up writing a book, Are You Ready? How to Build a Legacy to Die For, to do just that, to help us think about the legacy that we're building with every interaction we have, with every person that we meet, and to look at death and dying and not be afraid of it. I'm not afraid of death and die. I'm not afraid to die. And then also to look at what do we need to do to make sure that when we do go, that our children are the best prepared that they can be because of our efforts. So I have my legacy, a big legacy journal. I have a big binder that has everything in it, titles of my car, who sold the house, all the house details, where all my bank statements are, where my retirement plan is, all of those things, all of the passwords. I have a binder that has all of that in there so that when I die, my children know exactly where it is. When I die, they can go pick out the binder and everything they'll need to know, everything they need to cope with my death afterwards is in that binder. And I'm encouraging people to think about how we can make life easier for our survivors after we die.
Right, because we or they are so busy grieving and so upset. And then to unfortunately have to go right into the business and the serious and make decisions and not knowing where to do, where to go, or what your wishes are, or how to finance all of those wishes as well. So it's nice to have one packet ready to go.
And even where to get the money, how to get the hold of the money that you need to finance a funeral, or to, you need to make sure that you leave your children or whoever you want to leave as the beneficiaries of your checking account so that when you die, you have to sign some papers, but so that when you die, automatically these people will have access to your checking account or in your savings account. So they'll have access to that. So then they can pay for the things that need to take place after you die.
Right. So we're kind of jumping right into that. But with that, do you think it's best to have somebody on your account? I guess that's kind of hard because people could die at any time, unfortunately, you're planning a suicide, you wouldn't know that. And so younger people might not, you don't want somebody on your bank account. But as you get older, you put your children on there. But what about when you're younger? How does that work? You just have the documents to state that it goes to somebody?
Yeah, there are documents you can sign in I think every bank that says that when I die, this person will have access to my account automatically. The idea of getting someone on your account gets a little tricky because one of the things you fight for when you're my age is your independence. You know, you want to be independent. You don't want to be a burden. You don't want anyone else, you know, having to help you. You want to kind of take care of things yourself. Now, of course, there might come a time when I can, and then you give your power of attorney to somebody and you let them take care of that. But that's kind of a battle. And when you see, when you talk with people in their 70s and their 80s, most of them really want to stay independent as much as possible and not have someone else on their account. They want to live their lives, do their thing without feeling that their children have to get too involved. Just kind of like when you were children and your parents were too involved. It's kind of the other way around. Things turn around when you get older. Yeah, it's really kind of funny that way, because in some ways my kids take care of me, and a lot, for instance, Easter is coming up, and you know, where do I go for Easter? I just wait for the kids to figure out where I'm going, and I just go wherever they tell me. But there are certain things that my kids have taken over now, and that's good. But the checking account is one of those issues. You have to be careful and confident and comfortable to do that. But you can sign papers in a bank that will state that when you die, this person will have access to your account. And that's a very important thing to do. So planning ahead. And also when you have not only your life insurance for people, but your savings accounts, your retirement funds, you need to make sure that the beneficiaries are clearly stated on those accounts. That makes it so much easier for your survivors to take care of all those things.
Yeah. So I met you and I got a copy of your book and I read your book. And just the way timing is, it's like, I just actually won it. And how later on things kind of make sense there. I was like, wow. So right after that, so my mother-in-law passed away kind of unexpectedly. And I went through all this stuff and I was like, wow. And of course I picked it up and kind of browsed through it a little bit at that point. And then all of a sudden I'm like, wow. And so I read it and it helped a lot.
Thank you.
And it's like, so you never know when you're going to need this information. And I really like how you talked about just death and dying in the beginning, because that's the first thing you do. You process it and the emotions and the sadness, and you have to go through that as well. Do you want to explain how, like, the process of your book? And because then you go kind of, it was so perfect because you went into that and then you went into the paperwork and the stuff and then how to prepare. Now, of course, I'm preparing my own stuff because I know what went well and what didn't, what I need to do. And so you wrote it just perfectly in order. So do you want to explain kind of how you did that and what the process was? And yeah.
Well, it's funny because I never thought, you know, I was a dentist and then I was a speaker. And then as I'm getting older, you know, the 3-hour speaking engagements that you do if you're a clinical speaker kind of were getting a little tiring for my voice. My voice would start to give up first. I thought, oh, I better, you know, I got to wait. What else can I do now? And so suddenly I just felt that this was a book people needed, because we aren't prepared. We live in a death denying culture. We don't prepare for death. In fact, we do everything we can. Look at all the effort we make on keeping healthy, which we need to continue to do, because the longer we're healthy, the longer we can leave a legacy. So we need to keep doing that. But to know that no matter how good we've been on our diets and no matter what shape we're in, at some point, we are still going to die. So we still have to prepare for that. Even though we take so many steps to prolong our life, we still need to understand that it's going to happen at some point. No one has lived forever. You know, we're going to die at some point. We have an expiration date. So that's the first important thing I think we needed to think about. So the book was divided into three parts. The first part, we talk about legacy. You know, what legacy are you leaving? And I'm not really talking about money. I'm talking about the emotional legacies that we leave, the people that we love. And we leave a legacy to every person we meet, every contact we have. I happen to have 6 grandchildren, and I think they were the inspiration for the book. Again, when my husband died, they were so devastated, and I want to really leave a legacy for them. So I started thinking, well, what are the legacies that we leave? There are many of them. The best and most important one is leaving a legacy of love. We can all leave a legacy of love. And as I look, when you get to be 67, I've met a lot of very interesting people in my life. It's amazing when you look back on the people that you've met. So I was able to get stories. I'm a Holocaust survivor. I work in Rwanda. I do memorial libraries for my son. We have 65 libraries. We've sent over 350,000 books to Rwanda. So I spent a lot of time there, and they survived a horrible genocide. You look at the perspective of a Holocaust survivor, a genocide survivor, and how in the world could they ever be joyful in their lives again? It's just hard to imagine. But I learned so much from them, people that have really struggled with difficult things. So the first third of the book is all about legacy. What kind of legacies can you leave? A trust, a legacy of faith, legacy of friendship, so many of them. And there are more legacies than even I've listed, but positive legacies, things that we can teach the next generation that will help them survive and thrive after we're gone. In the middle of the book, I talk about death and dying. And in the process of this book, I became a death doula because I figured I really needed to learn a little bit more about this process. And it was a fascinating education. And I now help people kind of prepare these legacy books for the time when they're gone. And looking at death is so fascinating, because people have different ideas about what's going to happen. You know, I'm a Christian. I have certain ideas. I believe I'm going to see my family again. I'm, you know, my both feet in on that one. Other people believe that you be reincarnated. I've talked, and one of the most fascinating things you can do is if you're in a group of people, especially ones you don't know, ask them what they think is going to happen when they die. The first thing they do is kind of start to get startled, because it's not usually something you ask. But if you're in a trusting relationship where people feel they're not going to be judged, it is unbelievable what people think is going to happen to them after they die. It really opens up a lot of discussion when you ask that question. But people have different beliefs on that. But the reality is, whether you believe, you know, that you're going to go up into heaven, or you're going to be reincarnated, or you're just going to be gone, your legacy is still important. And if you love people here on earth, you want to make their continued journey as easy as possible. You want to pave that way for them to have a happy, harmonious journey where they're thriving and they're flourishing. That's what we want. So no matter what you think about death, understand that it's going to happen, and we need to prepare the people behind us. And then the last part, the last third of the book, is a workbook where I've researched through a number of, there are lots and lots of books out there that talk about the steps that you need to take, all the things you need to leave for the people behind you, including passwords and, you know, where your insurance money is, where all of these pieces are, a title to your car. I also have a list for how to prepare them emotionally, which I think is the part that I think is so critical. And the first thing to do is understand the grief and mourning process. When my son died, also about a year after he died, I was a practicing dentist. I was practicing full time. My husband had liver cancer and had just had a transplant. So I was the primary breadwinner in my family. And all of a sudden, I was diagnosed with nerve damage in my drilling fingers. And the doctors at Mayo Clinic said, okay, you're done. So I just lost my son a year ago. My husband could work a day or two a week, and that's okay. And now I'm done. My whole identity as a clinical dentist was over in one day. Although I certainly had symptoms up until that point, but I was a little bit of denial. And so all of a sudden, my role as a dentist was gone too. So another, you know, my identity was shrinking. And so I felt at that time I had a little time on my hands. So I thought, well, what am I going to do? I really do need a grief counselor. But, you know, we dentists sometimes are a little bit type A, and I'm in the baby boomer generation. So we don't really get help as we should have. The millennials and Generation X are much better at seeking help, you know, psychological issues. But we're not so good at that. So, of course, I did what any, you know, dentist would do, is I became a grief counselor because I had time. So I studied, became certified, and I was doing some grief counseling in my church. But I realized at that time that my grief had not been resolved yet. I'd still not worked through it. So although I could help other people, I would, every time I worked with somebody, I'd kind of go further down in the pit, you know. So my going up was I would go up, and then I'd help somebody else, and then I'd go down, and then I'd go up. So I realized that I needed to get fully healed, or more healed than I was. But during that time, my favorite part of this, the grief counseling education I got, was learning about the tasks of mourning. We all know about the stages of grief, you know, stages. Stages kind of like where you're going to go through them. There's not much you can do, but there are tasks of mourning. And I love the word task, because then it gives me something to hold on to. That just helps me. We're all different in how we heal. This is just the way I am.
Yeah, then you can check it off, because that's how.
Check it off. So I'm a checker offer. So you basically, the first task would be accepting what's going on. The second task would be trying to define the world as it is, kind of can make the adjustments to the world as you see it. Then there's a task of processing the grief. That's actually the second task, is processing the grief. And then the fourth task, and the task that kind of we all work towards, is putting the person you're grieving somewhere in your heart, somewhere on, you know, somewhere in your being, and then living your life without that shroud of grief. And anybody that's been through a grieving process knows you walk around like a zombie with this shroud on you for a certain period of time. The task is to remember that person. You can't deny that person existed. You can't just pretend it didn't happen, have a place for that person, and then move forward in your life without letting that grief affect your daily living. Now, I have 6 grandchildren, and it's taken 15 years for my son, and it's now been 3 years for my husband. We were kind of prepared for, you know, we kept thinking he goes, you know, we would think he's going to die, then he didn't. And so when he finally did die, it was like, well, wait a minute.
Right.
He got to come back, and then he did. But so it was a little easier on me because I was prepared, and I was a caretaker for the last year, and I was in hospice, so I had been a little more prepared. But I can truthfully say that I live in the moment with all 6 of my grandchildren, and that shroud that we carry around with us for a long time is no longer there. And that's what we work for. We work to be able to live in the moment without that shroud hanging over us. And it doesn't happen overnight. It happens differently for everybody. Took me a long time, you know, especially with my son, and a little less time with my husband because I was prepared. But that's what we all strive for, is to get rid of that shroud.
So it's kind of like letting some light back in,
yes,
you know, the darkness. And then I know grief, you know, it comes in waves. I've been through some stuff, and you could be having a great day, and all of a sudden it just hits you. Do you still get those waves after 15 years?
I mean, yeah, I used to get terrible waves. And in fact, my son was a student at Columbia University. He was a very brilliant student. And so for many years, hearing the word Columbia or New York would set me off, just, you know, just into one. You know, I'd be walking along, kind of thinking I was doing pretty good, and then bam, I flat down on the sidewalk. And it was everywhere. If you think about it, Columbia and New York are everywhere. That's kind of a sneaky one, because it is in a lot of places. Columbia, South Carolina, Columbia the country, Columbia the glacier, Columbia shuttle was going on at that time. And even when I would go in my closet and I'd be looking for some clothes, and I'd see a shirt with Columbia sportswear. I mean, it was like,
yeah, I'm glad I'm not wearing my Columbia stuff.
It's crazy.
It's just crazy
how that works and how it works in your brain. But I was able to work through that. Of course, that doesn't happen anymore. But things can trigger you. And fortunately, at this time, there is a wave, but it's not the tsunami that it was. It's a little wave. I just, you know, I don't, Sophie, I like to talk about the grief pit. You know, I've been down, as many of us have, in the bottom of the grief pit with like one nostril above to get air, you know, you're just struggling and trying to get out. And I have not gone down into that bottom for a long time, but you're up in the top areas. You know, I might fall a little bit here and there on an anniversary, but for the most part, I'm able to live in the moment without that shroud, or the waves that come are not really waves anymore. They're kind of just little ripples.
Right. Mine's a Black Friday. Of course, it comes every year. And Black Friday, I'm like, yeah, just triggers. But like you said, they do get better, and you're able to like even say it, you know, or after a while. Yeah, but it takes a while. And you're talking about building a legacy of love. And when you talk about carrying that person, the memory with you, is that like the legacy you're talking about? You know, the legacy you want to build is so people have good memories of fond love, and then they can remember you later on your birthday or anniversaries. You can, instead of being down with the nostril, you know, trying to get a little bit of air, you can actually like embrace that legacy and that love and actually feel good, you know, feel good and love and celebration instead of so much grief.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. Yeah. And I think for me, what happened is, you know, in the first part of your grief, it's hard to think about. I mean, and we all grieve differently. When my son died, I couldn't go into his room for 2 years, but my husband would go in there and sit every night for a while. And at first it would kind of make me a little upset that he'd go in the gym. Why are you doing that? Because he'd come out very sad, but that was just how he grieved. So when you are grieving as a couple or as a family, it's important to know that every single person is going to grieve differently. So my husband needed to grieve by being there, being in his room. I really, seriously, it was 3 years, 2 or 3 years. I can't remember how long, but about that time before I even walked into his room, I didn't even stop. It was just the same as it was before, which is kind of crazy. Most people might think that we let the room sit there like that for all that time. So we might.
No, time kind of stops. I'm sure it didn't seem like 3 years to you. It was like yesterday. Yeah.
Like yesterday. Yeah. So it's important for us to understand that everyone's going to grieve differently, and that everyone has a different grief journey. So you can't expect, and I'm guilty of that myself before I went through all this, to think like, well, you know, it's been 2 years. Little Mary should be over this by now. She should be. Well, you know what? Maybe some Marys would be over it, but some are not. And there are people, and I think we all know some, who can never work through the grief, can never get task number 2 done. They can never work through the grief. And that's why it's so critical to try hard. And I think sometimes we feel so overcome that we don't have the ability to do that. And I would really like to encourage everyone to just fight it. I learned that from one of my husband's cousins, who about 2 weeks after Eric died, we were back at work, we're back in our dental office. And I was in the zombie stage, you know, kind of walking around. And I was walking outside of the office. My husband was with a cousin of his, and they were talking by the car outside. And the cousin came up to me with his finger wagging, and he's wagging his finger at me. Like, I'm a zombie grieving mother, right? Don't wag your finger at me. He was wagging his finger at me and said, "Don't you ever let your remaining children feel that they are not enough." And he just was shouting that. He was so emotional. And it caught me by surprise. And I thought, what are you saying to me? And then I thought, oh my goodness, he's right. And the reason he was right, and only he could say this, if someone else had said it, it wouldn't have come out the same way. But he was right because he had lost his brother at 19 years old. He'd been out drinking and he was passed out, and his friends thought they were doing him a favor, put him in the car, left him in front of the house. But this is Minnesota. It was like -5 degrees outside, and he froze to death in his car. And his parents could never get over that. So essentially, this young man lost his brother and his parents on the same day. And he was really telling me, do not let that happen to you. And it was one of the most important things to have happened to me for him to say that. Because when you are grieving, it's very hard to get out of that pit. And his words made me realize that I had a husband and two daughters that still needed me. And it really gave me motivation when I was down to fight, because you have to fight. You have to fight and scrape and kick your way out of that pit. You don't just come out easily. So it takes a lot of effort and a lot of work. And thank goodness I got the motivation to do that. But I know it's you cannot ever judge someone with how they react to grief.
Yeah, and your pit, I mean, unfortunately, it's like the pittiest of the pit. So yeah, to get out of that. Do you think a lot of trouble with getting over grief is like guilt, like for why you feel guilty? Like, I feel guilty if I don't feel pain every day, if I don't hurt every day, I feel guilty for not suffering or for not feeling that.
Yes, absolutely. And it's important for you to remember, no matter what, now I'm again a Christian, and part of our faith is the joy of the Lord is your strength. So being joyful is something that part of my faith tells me we need to really strive for, it to be joyful. So that helped me. However, for anybody, it's important to remember that whether you have that type of faith or not, how would your loved one want you to feel 6 months after, a year after? Or would your loved one want you to be out of that pit and happy and moving forward with your life?
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Dental Ailments Podcast. For more episodes and to learn more about what's new and cool in the dental profession, check out our website at rootyouon.com. You'll find links to our previous episodes, our guests, how to contact our guests, special deals, anything like that. You can watch the videos on YouTube, our YouTube channel. And yeah, check us out. Until next time, cheers.